Christmas is just 5 days away. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, we'll get in the spirit of the season with an hour of holiday essays, poems, and music. We'll even visit the Mulvane Art Museum in Topeka, which is featuring a special exhibit this month on the life of Christ by artist Albert Bloch. One of the best-loved traditions of the season is the annual Christmas pageant. Cheryl Unruh of Emporia remembers her first pageant in this essay, Christmas Eve.
As a kid, the thought of appearing on stage terrified me. When I was 5 years old, preparing for my first Christmas Eve performance, I practiced my line 17 million times. I played those four words over and over until they left a permanent crease in my brain. Every year at the Pawnee Rock Bergthal Mennonite Church, each Sunday school class presented a Christmas Eve poem or a skit, and the congregation rounded out the evening with Christmas carols. My class was supposed to recite a poem about the stars over Bethlehem, and each of us had one line to deliver. Dressed in white choir robes, we each carried a star on a stick, the cardboard stars cut from cereal boxes and covered with aluminum foil. I didn't want to flub my line. My parents were in the audience, my brother, my friends, grandparents, and grandma's sisters. Well, actually, I was related to nearly everyone in the congregation, in one way or another. Our ancestors came over on the same boat, literally. In 1874, they sailed to America on the steamship City of London. About 30 Mennonite families found their way to the Pawnee Rock area in Barton County. Their passports had been delayed for months, so rather than arriving in Kansas in early spring, they got here in November. Having no time to build shelter before the snow hit, the Santa Fe Railroad provided boxcars for housing that first winter. Over the decades, the congregation built several churches. The brick building currently in use was constructed in 1915, about 3 miles north of Pawnee Rock. It's on a rise, surrounded by pastures and farmland. On a winter's evening, stepping inside the church felt like a warm embrace, and the background murmur of voices was low and comforting. The sanctuary was always packed for the Christmas Eve program. Kids came home from college, families returned from Chicago or Dallas or from wherever their jobs had scattered them. And on that evening when I was 5, my classmates and I walked onto the stage. Our teacher lowered the microphone and nodded at me. I stepped up, the star on a stick clutched in my sweaty grip, and I recited my line without flaw. I am a star. In the years since I moved away from home, I've returned maybe a half dozen times for the Christmas Eve program. As an adult, you watch the children perform, and you find yourself leaning in, willing them to do well, so that they'll feel proud of themselves. It's been quite a few years since I attended the church's Christmas Eve program, but a sideline scene from one particular night has stayed with me. In my line of vision, I could see a woman named Shelley, who was holding her infant. The baby sat in her lap, facing her, and in the middle of the evening's program, the child spit up on her, making a huge mess. I watched this mother as she found a fresh cloth and cleaned first her infant and then her own black dress. And she did this without drawing attention, without a wrinkle to her nose, without a single look of disgust. I was taken by Shelley's serenity, her calm countenance, the tenderness in her touch. O holy night and joy to the world were among the hymns sung that evening. But the song I carried home with me a silent night. One moment of a mother's unconditional love made real the scene of round yon virgin, mother and child, and what I observed was nothing less than love's pure light.
Thank you. The donkey stood absolutely still in front of the pulpit as though stuffed by a taxidermist, its halter reins resting loosely in the hands of a high school boy. Around the animal was the splendor of the Christmas Eve pageant. Glistening golden straw covered the chancel floor. On the left, junior high shepherds were mesmerized by a sheep. Its owner, a real shepherd, gently held it around the neck. Just to the right of the donkey, kindergarten and first grade angels were staggered on the chancel steps. They wore silky white miniature robes over Christmas dresses, garland crowns for halos, and stood a little bit proud, yet a little bit scared of the full house of worshipers. Mary, a real mom, sat on a bale of hay holding a real baby, just a couple of weeks old, Joseph just behind her. There was a crude manger in front of her, the most authentic prop in the scene. The congregation finished "O Little Town of Bethlehem." An echo from the organ pipes drifted away, then quiet. The tableau was set. In this thick, slow silence, the previously immovable donkey bared his gums and turned toward the kindergarten angel next to him, as though he might ask her if he had something stuck in his teeth. Apparently, the make-believe of the pageant had not prepared the child for the reality of those bony bicuspids gleaming in front of her. What might have been an endearing moment was lost in a piercing scream, a diva high note gone guttural. The girl's mother raced to the front and extracted the child with the precision of a Navy SEAL team. A ripple of laughter dissipated in soft light, returning us to the wonder of the pageant. Christmas pageants have always been a part of my life. Growing up in a tiny western Oklahoma town, our church barely had enough kids to portray all the ancient characters. As a child, I coveted the wise man role, which was always assigned to the older boys. They got to process stiffly down the aisle to We Three Kings, like imperial walkers in Star Wars, carrying a shoebox wrapped in foil or a coffee can spray-painted gold. The younger boys like me were relegated to being shepherds, glibly entering from the side door to 10 poorly designed plywood sheep held steady with bricks. The year came when I was certain I would be elevated to royalty. I would cast off my brown terry cloth bathrobe for a shiny blue house robe donated by someone's mother. No such luck. My Sunday school teacher affixed a bath towel over my head with an elastic band, pinching my ear over my glasses. There were tears. Pageantry, at least on the local level, is a mix of theater and spectacle, of procession and recitation, and of course, actual or near mishaps. We gather what we have, or can buy at the craft store, and congregate to tell whatever story our culture or religion deems central to our identity. In fact, part of the ritual is the assemblage itself, unpacking and fitting costumes, gathering the children for rehearsal. As a child, disenchanted though I was with the shepherd role, I felt the anticipation of the community. I could sense that we were gathering to tell an essential part of our collective narrative, though telling was not enough. We needed dramatic embellishments to celebrate what is, in many pageant scripts, a story of simple, humble people overcoming dire circumstances. My young pageant roles were a springboard for a professional gig as a Christmas pageant director at the same church of the donkey incident. If Standard & Poor had rated holiday pageants instead of credit ratings, ours would have scored above the middle. Handmade costumes, a real sheep, and fine music with a secret surprise, the Shriner Parade Camel. Full-sized and as real as camels get in Kansas, its head moves side to side. It came with silky, colorful costumes for adult wise men. They were accompanied by an entourage of children, children about the age I had been as a terry cloth shepherd so many years ago. Like a small Rose Bowl float, the camel glided down the aisle to the organ blaring We Three Kings, with children straining to see the massive beast. Its arrival was the final addition to the tableau. The story had been told again. Our community reflected on its meaning. Another layer of human narrative had been added to a scene forever assembled. Thank you.
Jody Johnson is a writer living in Lawrence. Eric McHenry is the current Poet Laureate of Kansas. He shares with us three poems of the season.
This is The Oxen by Thomas Hardy, and it's a late 19th or maybe early 20th century poem. I'm not sure exactly when he composed it, but it's written in hymnal measure, which is lines of tetrameter and trimeter, four beats and then three beats alternating, and it sounds a little like a Christmas hymn or a tune. And I like the musicality of it, and I also like the sentiment. It's a poem that looks back both at a bygone era and also at the bygone era, specifically of one's own childhood, and misses it, and maybe misses a little bit of the kind of faith that was possible back then, back when we were younger as a people, or back when I was younger as a person. The Oxen. Christmas Eve, and 12 of the clock. Now they are all on their knees, an elder said, as we sat in a flock by the embers in hearthside ease. We pictured the meek, mild creatures where they dwelt in their strawy pen. Nor did it occur to one of us there to doubt they were kneeling then. So fair a fancy few would weave in these years. Yet I feel, if someone said on Christmas Eve, come, see the oxen kneel. In the lonely barton by yonder coombe, our childhood used to know. I should go with him in the gloom, hoping it might be so. This is a poem by a poet named Thomas R. Smith, and I don't know anything else about him or his work. It's a relatively recent poem. It's called Housewarming, and I love it because it speaks to a feeling that I think is common to so many people, that although time moves forward and pulls us apart from each other and changes things from the way that we were, we all retain this feeling, this intuition that it's going to go back to the way that it was, that somehow we're all going to be together again. And I particularly like it when he's mentioning the members of his family in this poem, that he mentions brothers and sister. The specificity of the singular sister there makes us know that it's his family, really, that he's talking about. It's not a universal figure for a family. This is very personal to him. Housewarming. In my dream, I was the first to arrive at the old home from church. Wind and night had forced through the cracks. I pushed inside, turned on the lamps, lit a fire in the stove. Frozen oak logs stung my fingers. It was good pain, my hands reddening on the icy broom handle as I swept away snow. On Christmas Eve, I prepared a warm place for my mother and father, sister and brothers, grandparents, all my relatives, none dead, none missing, none angry with another, all coming through the woods. This is Christmas East of the Blue Ridge by Charles Wright. That's a poem that I really fell for when I was young, maybe just out of college. And it's, of these poems, the most mysterious to me, I think, in many ways. But I'm fascinated by the beauty and the music of the language in it. I had committed this to memory long before I felt like I'd really begun entering it as a poet and as a poem. And I think I'm still working on getting to the bottom of it. Christmas East of the Blue Ridge. So autumn comes to an end with these few wet, sad stains stuck to the landscape. December dark, running its hands through the lank hair of late afternoon. Little tongues of the rain holding forth under the eaves. Such wash, such watery words. So autumn comes to this end, and winter's vocabulary, downsized and distant, drop by drop, captures the conversation with its monosyllabic gutturals and tin music, gravelly consonants, scratched vowels. Soon the camel drivers will light their fires. Soon the stars will start on their brief dip down from the back of heaven, down to the desert's dispensation and night reaches, the gall and first birth. The second, only one word from now. One word and its death from right now. Meanwhile, in Charlottesville, the half moon hums like a Hottentot high over Monticello. Clouds dishevel and rag out. The alphabet of our discontent keeps on with its lettering. Gold on the black walls of our hearts.
Eric McHenry is the current Poet Laureate of Kansas. We'll hear from him again later this hour. Wyatt Townley was Poet Laureate of Kansas from 2013 to 2015. She shares with us several poems of the season from her books, The Afterlife of Trees and The Breathing Field.
New Year's Eve. We carry the body like some inner constellation into the new year. Shoulders singing in the wind. A map of the past we thought was outdated, light years back, but leading from dot to dot, injury to injury. A harmony of sorrows sung in every scar. Beginning again with the lucent moon, the biggest in years, the breath a knife slicing the way through the lilac dark. You, me, and the willow rushing in the same damn direction. Combed back by moonlight, stung by stars. I've always wanted to get inside and live inside a snow globe. So this is called Inside the Snow Globe. At last, you are in the blizzard behind glass. This trail of flakes, your cape of disappearance. Dogs romp on the path. Skaters twirl on the lake. Under the ice, life swirls. The yellow chapel is forever framed by evergreens, and at the end of the pathway, the scene starts over. The skaters are still turning. It is still snowing, turning and snowing. Moving from solid to scattered, effervescent to evanescent, takes a lifetime. Everything is nothing if you look long enough.
Wyatt Townley was Poet Laureate of Kansas from 2013 to 2015. She lives in Mission with her husband, fellow writer Roderick Townley. His most recent book is A Bitter Magic. Here he reads an excerpt from his short story, The Invitation.
Cove scraped the dinner dishes while Lila splashed in the tub upstairs. The phone rang. David Cove? You got him. Mr. Cove, this is Marilyn Fine. I know who you are. Direct as ever. I'd like to come over sometime and take a look at your wife's paintings. I might want to take one of them for the gallery. Cove stared out the kitchen window at the increasing snow. It would be a white Christmas after all. Why, has her stock gone up? Excuse me? You weren't interested in Anne's painting when she was alive. I was always interested in them. I just didn't think they were saleable. And now? Cove heard her daughter's voice calling from the bathroom. I may have been wrong. Daddy! Miss Fine, can I call you back after I get my daughter to bed? I would like that. He took the number and hung up. What is it, hon? He started up the stairs. Who was it? He looked at the wet little five-year-old, her mop of brown hair rubber-banded on top. You got me off the phone to ask who I was talking to? She smiled and sank down in the suds. Read Pippi. After you do your teeth. With a sigh, Lila piled her plastic boats on the back of the tub and let the water out. She slid back and forth in the empty tub. Come on, you. Cove held the oversized towel. I'm cold, she squealed and wrapped herself in the towel like a larva. Finally, he got her teeth brushed, and they read a chapter from Pippi Longstocking, Cove leaving out the part about Pippi's mother dying. It was taking longer than ever to get Lila to sleep. Tonight, he was summoned half a dozen times from the living room, where he'd started a fire in the hearth. Don't worry, Daddy, she said the last time he came up. Worry about what? Don't worry about Mommy. Am I worried? Lila nodded gravely. But she's in heaven. I know. He kissed her smile, then scooped the cat off the bed. Say good night to Tangle, he said. Tomorrow's a school day. Downstairs, he put another stick on the fire and called Marilyn Fine. She wanted to come by tomorrow. What's the hurry? I may have a buyer for one of the paintings. A Christmas present for his wife, I think. Which painting? The field with the tree. I believe it's in your bedroom. You called it sentimental. Did I? I don't think there's anything sentimental about $2,500. It's not for sale. Mr. Cove, David, you don't mind my asking, how are you doing these days? I guess I do mind. You know better than I if an extra $2,500 would come in handy this time of year. If I remember, you take 50%. That's right, $1,250 then. For that painting? Her work isn't that well known. Right now, I don't think I could get more than that. Cove sighed. Outside the window, the snow was sifting down faster. Are you there? She said. I'm here. The painting's not for sale. Later, Cove sat by the fireplace with a sewing basket. He lifted a sock and stared at it as if he'd never seen such a thing before. He had never learned to sew, and now Lila's clothes were scarred with sutures. $1,250 for Anne's painting. Well, he could handle the mortgage, buy a few presents, even pick up a can or two of market spice tea. Then it would be gone, and he'd be no better off. He'd be worse off. There would be an empty space above the bookcase, across from the bed. He panicked at the thought of losing Anne color by color. Let's take a look at this valuable painting, he thought, heading upstairs. He turned out the bedroom lights, leaving on a small gooseneck atop the bookcase, then sat cross-legged on the bed. There was something sudden about the picture, despite the pastoral subject. It showed a field with tall, wind-bent grasses tipped with sunlight. Just to the right stood an oak tree, its leaves swimming. A blanket, half in shade, was spread beneath. Deft strokes suggested a basket, a bottle of wine, two glasses, and that, except for a distant turbulence and a tilting bird, was all. The invitation, it was called. To him, it was fierce with expectancy, but then he knew the story behind it. He remembered the night when Anne had turned to him in bed and whispered, "Meet me in the field." Another dream date, he had said. She nodded, her brown eyes bright. Last night I dreamed I was in a field. I remember I was going to meet you. He smiled in a way his colleagues would not have recognized. His brisk manner disappeared when he thought of Anne. The two of them worried about the likelihood that one would outlive the other. How would the survivor go on? They decided to experiment, trying several dream scenarios. Then Anne came up with the field. She described the look of the grass, the lay of the sunlight, the green-black shadows of the oak. Then they kissed and drifted to sleep. Next morning, Anne had brought him a cup of tea. "Where were you?" she said. "I waited all night under the tree." Cove felt ashamed of his incoherent and irrecoverable dreams, but proud of her. She had actually put herself in the field and remembered he was coming. They tried again. This time, they both failed. Then she made the painting. 3 days before Christmas, the furnace broke. Cove had let the service contract lapse, so he was faced with a charge just to have someone come and take a look. The heating man climbed up from the cellar, rubbing his hands on his coveralls, to announce that repairs would cost $270. At dinner that night, Cove and Lila sat with blankets around their shoulders. Their breath hung in the air. "Let's eat by the fire," he said. Lila slid off her chair and carried her macaroni into the other room. Cove had laid a blanket on the floor, like a picnic, and built up the fire. It was a cheery scene, the flames before them, the blinking Christmas lights behind. Lila's brown hair glowed in fiery ringlets. "We could make believe we're in a field," he said. And Mommy, he thought, was coming to meet us. Would that upset Lila if he said that? "Daddy, I'm cold." "I know. I'm getting the man here tomorrow." Lila just looked at him. She knew more than he wanted her to. She had heard him talking to the hospital people on the phone, working out a payment plan. "Daddy, you don't have to do anything." "What do you mean?" "Presents and stuff."
Shush.
"We're fine." "I mean it, Daddy." "Hushaboo. Here." He rubbed her thin arms until she giggled. After Lila was asleep, he called Marilyn Fine. "Can you meet me here tomorrow at noon? Bring your checkbook."
That's Roderick Townley reading from his short story, The Invitation. We'll hear the rest of The Invitation later this hour. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. If you're just joining us, it's a holiday episode of KPR Presents with stories, poems, and songs of the season. Just in time for Christmas, the Mulvane Art Museum in Topeka is hosting a special exhibit this month. It's Scenes from the Life of Christ by Kansas artist Albert Block. Julie Myers is curator at the Mulvane Art Museum at Washburn University.
Albert Block was born in St. Louis, and as a young man, he traveled to Germany to study art. He was there in 1911, and he gave up his idea of studying at the traditional art school and fell in with a group of very avant-garde modernist artists who were called the Blue Rider Group. Particularly, he was close to Wassily Kandinsky and to Franz Marc, the leaders of the group. And these artists were breaking down boundaries by not painting naturalistically or realistically, but using color, shape, line, form, space in a more expressive way. And he was very interested in things spiritual. Kandinsky had actually written a book called Concerning the Spiritual in Art, and Block was really on the same wavelength on that. So when he came back, he really didn't want to get involved in the commercial art world. He taught for one term in Chicago, and then he came to the University of Kansas, where he pretty much, I won't say was a recluse. He wasn't a recluse. He was very active in the community in Lawrence, but he did not try to promote himself in New York or Chicago or any of the other venues. He just wanted to paint, teach, write poetry, and he also translated philosophy from the German. So he was really a true intellectual in that sense of the word. And then he stayed here. He continued teaching into the 50s at KU, and then he had a heart attack and had to stop teaching. But he continued to paint until he died in 1961. So he was a huge presence in the Kansas art scene through the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, etc.
This exhibit includes 23 works of art by Albert Bloch, but since it's the Christmas season, I'd like to concentrate on one work in particular.
Well, this is a very interesting cover of a magazine called The Mirror, and it's the title is Christmas 1912. Bloch had gone to Europe with the support of a man named Reedy, who was the editor of this magazine, The Mirror, in St. Louis, and he sent back works that he had done while he was in Munich. He sent them back to St. Louis, and then they would appear in this publication called The Mirror. And so what we have here is a nativity scene, but what we can see is that it's definitely done in a style that is more up to date than what anybody would have been seeing in St. Louis at the time. And in fact, Reedy wrote back to him and said, "Wow, this is a little bit out of the league of our readership, but okay, we will show it." And what is distinguishing this from more realistic representations of the Nativity is his very sinuous and rhythmic use of line to define the figures. The figures are not very much defined in three dimensions. The three-dimensionality of the figure is simply shown by line, not shading. The colors are also not naturalistic, but much more vibrant than you can imagine that you would see in an inn in Jerusalem in the zero century. And Mary, in particular, is in a pink color. Another really interesting aspect of this picture is that it shows Mary from behind. And so we really just see the head of Christ, Mary's back, and mostly what we're seeing here are the worshiping three wise men. And they each have very different expressions, of worship, of wonder and awe, with the hands raised. One of them is bending down. And then what's really fascinating about this picture is how the colors in the three wise men and Mary are kind of repeated in the background in a non-naturalistic play of color that really lights up the whole picture with the Star of Bethlehem at the left.
Julie, do you have another favorite work that's in this exhibit?
I have three other favorite works, and they're all on the theme of Gethsemane, because the show does go through the entire life of Christ, and they show kind of different times during the scene when Christ is spending the night on the Mount of Olives. One of the drawings shows him in just kind of abject terror as he's facing this reality that he's going to be crucified. His eyes are wide open in a very kind of scary look. His hands are clasped, and he seems to be wringing them, as you might if you're in high anxiety. And then another one, a painting that's actually owned by the Mulvane Art Museum, shows him later that night as he's resigned himself to this, to his fate, which of course he did. And we know that it's later in the night because in the background of the picture, we see the Roman soldiers with their swords sticking up as they're about ready to arrest him. And then the third Gethsemane is from after World War II, and Bloch often put contemporary references in his paintings because he really wanted his works of art to be universal and not just to be about, say, Christ's suffering, but to be about the suffering of mankind in general. And so in the third Gethsemane, we see Christ with his head bowed, weeping. But in the background, there are these explosions that possibly suggest some of the violence of World War II. And Bloch had actually sent a son to World War II. He did return alive, but World War II was such a horrific experience that we do find many references to it in Bloch's art.
Scenes from the life of Christ will remain on display at the Mulvane Art Museum until January 23rd for museum hours and more information. Go to their website, washburn.edu/Mulvane. Although Albert Bloch is best known as a painter, he was also a talented poet. In connection with this exhibit, the Mulvane hosted a reading from Bloch's epic poem, The Garden of the Asses. It's the story of Jesus with special attention to the donkey that played a prominent role in his life, from his birth in a stable to his family's flight into Egypt to Palm Sunday. This reading features Eric McHenry and Jeff Weinberg and was recorded at the Mulvane Art Museum on December 1st, 2015.
Out in the field behind the little house where he lived with his elders, a young child played thoughtfully. Off at some distance, cows were grazing with their calves, and nearby, mild and patient still, grown old now, a gray ass was tethered. Presently, a vagrant dog, happening by, espied there on the grass the poor small creature, and at once agog with interest or resentment at the sight of something on four legs, so different, both from his kind and cat's. With all his might, he set to barking and, on mischief bent, hurled himself at his victim, who, tied fast, stood all defenseless, for the length of thong which held him was but short. The child, aghast, looked helpless on a while, as, young and strong, the enemy attacked with noisy spite his lifelong faithful playmate, this old friend, now truly old, who in bewildered fright attempted pitiably to defend himself against the vicious snapping jaws, striking out bravely with his hoofs behind, too feeble now to hinder or make pause the dog in his assault. The child's eyes, blind with tears, ranged anxious, wildly, round about, seeking a weapon in his crazed despair, something to put the enemy to rout, stones or a stick, whatever might lie there. And lo, a miracle, all suddenly, how did it come there? What the mystery? He holds a rod and, angry face aglow, he stoutly drives away the yelping foe. And finds he has no weapon in his hand. But now he held it, now it is not there. He looks about, it is not anywhere. His eyes go big, he cannot understand. Weeping, he runs to comfort his good friend, feeding at peace, the dog forgotten quite. And as his little eager arms hold tight, in loving clasp, the gentle bowed head penned, he sobs. Perhaps he meant it all in fun. The poor dog knew no better, little one. But oh, my lifelong dear companion, you, my earliest playmate, never till I die, nor even then, shall I forget how true has your devotion been. How your grave eye, when I lay newly come upon the earth, in that poor tavern's barn, watched wonderingly this strange child creature. How you gave his birth such softly braying welcome, how we three, the mother, you, and I, guided by him whom I call father, kept together fast upon our homeward faring through the grim weather of winter, till we came at last back to the village where, our journey done, we rested, and you with us, faithful one. And nothing, nothing can make me forget how carefully you bore us, her and me, when for my safety we were forced to flee in secret from the land. Though what the threat of evil that hung over us, no more I know today than then I knew, for they have never told me, and still both ignore my questions, telling me to run and play, that I am still a very little boy, and must not trouble my too thoughtful mind about sad things, but rather snatch what joy brief childhood holds for me to seek and find. Still, though I am a little boy, I am a lonely boy, as always I have been. And but for you and that one white pet lamb I had down there in Egypt, I have seen seldom a playfellow or any child whom I remember now. Yes, there was one of my own age. He looked so shy and wild and weather-worn. The rain and wind and sun had tanned and roughened him until he seemed one with the earth and sky and beasts carefree that played beneath it. And his great eyes gleamed with such an ardent fire, it frightened me a little. Though he loved me well, and I loved him in turn, I cannot tell you why. He wore about his loins a clout of skins, and carried in his hand a little rod of reeds formed to a cross. He lisped of God and of repentance for man's grievous sins. I have not seen him since. Where is he gone? That dark-browed boy, whom hardly I recall. Was it in Egypt? Was it here that John came to me? No, I do not know at all. But there in Egypt, far away, there were with me the little lamb I loved, and you. Who else? Who else was there is all a blur to me, except those loving, anxious two who are about us always. But we three had happy times together all alone and needed none to keep us company when we romped in the meadow or sprawled prone, all tired out with play, upon the grass, where I might doze, lulled by the heavy smells of flowers, the while you two, the patient ass and helpless lamb, would stand as sentinels to keep good watch upon me as I slept. And when I woke, you had not moved one stride from me, and there the lamb was too, except that he would lie fast sleeping at my side. The three of us together had great fun when I was still so very small and young, and never felt the need of anyone besides for playmate. Always I have clung so hard to those I love, and how it tore my heart to leave the little lamb behind, staring so trustful after from the door, standing forsaken there, yet so resigned to waiting for us till the end of day, confident that we should return again. And always we had come back to him when, for a few hours, we had been away. But this one time, this last time, we were not returning. And alas, we might not take the dear friend with us who had shared our lot in that strange land. I feel the parting ache even now whenever I see little white lambs at their play in pasture. And I think I must have cried myself to sleep that night after we left him. Could I eat and drink at all that day, I wonder? But I know I did not dare to turn and wave goodbye. I could not look. I only could ask why he must remain behind, why we must go. But soon enough they made me understand, though that did not make easier the pain of knowing I should not see him again, why we could not take with us to our land our playfellow. He never could have stood the cruel long journey. That was all their fear, and must have died before we ever could have brought him home to be our playmate here. And he had found another family there. The mother had seen lovingly to that, a lonely neighbor who had sometimes sat gossiping with her, gladly took care of him, promising him her company. And yet I'm sure he misses you and me.
Oh, all ye patient creatures of the earth, despised, maltreated, held as nothing worth, unless your unthanked, unrequited toil profit your masters, heaven loves you well. Small, much enduring ass, for whom is named this garden to be founded, you with whom shall dwell your fellow creatures, shy, untamed, freed at last from your immemorial doom. Come, beasts that perish, all who labor and are heavy laden, there you shall have peace. forevermore be free of all command over you, and be yours the land's increase. For you this warm sunlight and pleasant shade, yours the bell clear and flower-scented air, yours the green pastures and still waters fair, for you alone the Eden shall be laid. And all things shall be as up on that day when they had first been made and were found good. The stars shall sing above, the fountains play, choiring together of God's fatherhood. And none shall enter with you to molest, and there shall be no tempter to seduce. Be unafraid. This garden shall be blessed and dedicated only to your use.
That's In the Garden of the Asses, excerpts from an epic poem by the late Albert Bloch of Lawrence. The Mulvane is hosting an exhibit of Bloch's paintings, Scenes from the Life of Christ, through January 23rd. Coming up, a Hanukkah story and Prayer for the New Year by Kansas writer Karen Miriam Goldberg. But first, the rest of The Invitation, a short story by Roderick Townley.
Finally, Christmas Eve. On the way home from the neighborhood party, Lila dozed in the back seat. Cove glanced at her in the mirror, watching shadows glide over her face. Arriving home, he bundled her in a blanket and carried her across the snowdrifts to the door. She moaned, but he got her to bed without waking her. Carefully, he pulled off her shoes while Tangle mewed. It was then he realized that the house was warm. The furnace man had come. Cove pulled wrapping paper from the closet, plugged in the tree, set the kettle on the stove, and pried open the new can of tea. With Christmas music on low, he set about wrapping the presents, ribbons and cards on each one. Lila would wake up tomorrow, early, and scurry downstairs. She would be excited, and she would open the presents, those lovely presents. Afterwards, he would make pancakes, and she would call her friends and play outside. Cove closed his eyes with a realization that he was bringing this girl up himself. He had no idea how he would get her from where she was to the woman she would become. But he felt that if he managed this first Christmas, he might manage the rest. After a final glance around the room, he unplugged the tree and climbed the stairs to the bedroom. Above the bookcase was a dim rectangle, lighter than the rest of the wall. Someone's wife would be opening a lovely Christmas present tomorrow. Cove slid under the covers and lay in darkness, watching the wall where the moonlight slanted in. His eyes closed. An afterimage remained, shimmering like a movie screen. The screen turned to steel. It was an elevator, and he was in it alone, going down. It bumped to a stop. Wet flagstones led along a brightening corridor toward daylight. He passed a lilac bush and found himself in the park, a path curving along a rise of land. He followed it till it turned to dirt, then to weeds raveling into a field. In the middle stood a rippling oak. Cove headed toward it through waist-high grass. He felt he was making no headway, but that the tree was staggering toward him. It was a massive thing, its shadows impenetrable. A blanket, half in shadow, lay beneath the outer branches. Beside it, a picnic basket. He came up to them, stunned to see that they were dummy props, papier-mâché. Even the shadow was painted on the stiff blanket. The wine bottle was painted wood, like a decoy. The wind was real, though. Roaring like surf, it rushed through the leaves. Cove stepped up to the line between sunlight and shadow, but did not cross. He tried to distinguish among shades of charcoal, dark green, purple-black. Branches groaned. Something moved from deepest shadow to lighter shadow. As it came closer, Cove saw it was a woman. Her summer dress caught patches of sunlight. "Oh, Anne," he heard himself cry, "I thought..." But it sounded foolish, now she was before him, to say what it was he thought. She came a few more steps and stopped, as if not permitted to go further. She was saying something. He could not catch the words. The wind was making such a racket. "What did you say? Tell me again." She smiled and shrugged, her arms slightly out from her side. The wind blew the dress against her. She pushed her hair from her face. "I love you, Anne. I love you. Can you hear me?" Finally, he gave up trying to speak. They stood in the flashing shadows and looked at each other. The leaves grew louder. The leaves were shouting.
That's The Invitation by Roderick Townley of Mission. We end with two pieces by Karen Miriam Goldberg. She was Poet Laureate of Kansas from 2009 to 2013.
This is the very end of my book, Needle in the Bone, and the subtitle is How a Holocaust Survivor and Polish Resistance Fighter Beat the Odds and Found Each Other. It's based on oral histories with two Lawrence men, Lou Friedman and Jarek Pekelkiewicz. Lou survived 6 concentration camps and 3 death marches. Jarek survived being part of the Polish underground and part of the Warsaw Uprising. He lost a lot of family and was on a POW march and in POW camps. And I just felt like their story was remarkable, but the way I chose to tell it is continually tossing in history and questions and my own quandaries and limitations and their voices and experiences with them. So this is just about a Hanukkah party that happened. I remember Hanukkah a few years ago, Jarek standing beside me saying, "You know, the candle lighting was very beautiful." He, his wife Moira, who seemed too alive to ever vanish, and 45 other people were jammed into our living room, kitchen, and dining room for our annual Hanukkah party. "You mean the menorah lighting?" "Yes, it's lovely," I said. "When I see all those candles lit, it makes me cry, but not tears of sadness. It just makes me happy," he replied. "Because we're all still here?" I asked Jarek. "Yes," he says. I kiss him on the cheek as Moira comes toward us, her arms outstretched, her face radiant. "It's so good to have the lads here together," she says, while I nod in agreement. The miracle isn't just that they survived. The miracle is how they found a way to live with courage, laughter, and joy while carrying those needles in the bone. In this piece, I kind of refer back to miracles because Hanukkah is a holiday based on a miracle. You know, the miracle of the oil in the lamps lasting for 8 days, which, you know, people say today would be the equivalent to a cell phone running for 8 days after the battery dies. Maybe not quite. But the oil in the lamp supposedly lasted for 8 days after the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed. And, of course, the lamp was in the temple. And Lou's story and Yarek's story, as well as some of the most powerful experiences of survival I've heard about all my life, have this thing in common. Not just that people survived and got through it, but that they took all these materials life has given them. And the materials might be that their whole way of growing up, their whole world was lost, and they had to reconstruct a new one. It may be that they lost many of their beloveds and they had to grow whole new families, or they lost their way of making a living and doing meaningful work and had to create new ways. And Lou and Yarek's story is very much about creating a new life and the courage that takes. And to me, that courage goes to the heart of what miracles are.
Thank you.
prayer for a new year. Let the snow gathered tight to the afternoon sky relax its grip and show us the white contours of the new world. Let the blankets hold the shapes of our sleeping all the dreams long. Let the cat on the dog's bed move over enough for the dog. Let the last one to leave the room close the lights, and the first one to rise make the coffee. Let the pebbles of sorrow in our pockets grow smooth in the rapids of our stories. Let the window hold the pink glow of the just rising sun and the infinite blue of the rising night. Let the flowers and stones make their way to the gravestones of those we love, no matter how tender the pain of their imprint. Let the quietest clearing in prairie or woods, party of one or crowd of crows, land us exactly where we are. Let the rain come hard and wild while we dance in our living rooms. As well, let come the storm warnings with time enough to find a basement. Let us remember the heat before the thunder while the silver light of winter surrounds us. Let us always notice the blue light of every day, reminding us we are not who we think we are, but only and at last canoes on the river of light and cooling water. Let us paddle hard when the current switches, and put down the paddle when the moon's face shines before us, below as above. Let us trust that we will always be led where we need to go.
That's Prayer for a New Year by Karen Miriam Goldberg. A special thanks to Karen and everyone who helped with today's KPR Presents: Roderick Townley, Wyatt Townley, Eric McHenry, Jeff Weinberg, Jody Johnson, and Cheryl Unruh. Thanks also to Julie Myers of the Mulvane Art Museum at Washburn University in Topeka. Again, their Albert Block exhibit, Scenes from the Life of Christ, is on display until January 23rd. Find out more at washburn.edu/Mulvane. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. From everyone at Kansas Public Radio, Merry Christmas.